Good afternoon, April 1st, 2022. The war in Ukraine rages on. Welcome, everybody. We're just waiting for people to realize that we have started. We have some very good questions. Those are good enough to very good, in fact, and what we will focus on after our rundown of the actual status. Bear in mind that all that information is always 2 days behind. And likewise, treat new information with a couple days of caution. I don't really respond to a one-sentence statement that's paraphrased from some official. Number one, it's a paraphrase. Number two, one sentence is 1,000% deprived of context. Number three, often turns out to either not be true, or it's clarified or reversed or made sense of within 2 days. And likewise, with these battle maps, I rely on the French Ministry of War, Ministry of the Army, their recon, their drones or satellites or whatever. They are a NATO country in the history of it, reluctantly. If you know the history of De Gaulle. So we look at this map that I shared earlier. You can see, in fact, I would implore you all to scroll up as I will so we can get our bearings to the 31 March 22 situation map from France. They didn't update this for a number of days. So you can see, if you're looking at the map, and if you're not, we should be able to describe it enough, well enough. I'll say in the east and the north, you know, the names of the places. So, and we won't belabor it too much, but just to get an idea of what's happening. Because people were under some idea of just so much misinformation and quotes taken out of context. It really does a disservice to understanding so much bad reportage on it. The thing is that what you have to understand is that Russia is not trying to take over the world and trying to establish a one world government. So they haven't established media feedback lines that address talking points in the English language in real time in response to misinformation and disinformation. What matters to Russia is what Russians think. I know that sounds crazy. But within Russia, there is a very big internet full of all types of blogs and websites, and there's pundits, and there's different TV shows and radio shows, like on AM radio, and you have all these shock jocks, and people talk about everything and everything going on all the time. They have a very lively and broad and deep national or internal dialogue between media and between people. So things that we think aren't clear, it doesn't mean that they aren't clear. They're just not trying to sell their story to a world that they're not trying to conquer. Does that make sense? You see, the thing is that CNN and fake news in the West was set up in the image of a media version of like the British Empire, to create soft power illusions about the superiority of this or the truthful nature of that. And there's just lots of people that were paid in money, literally printed in thin air out of never-ending budgets, to engage in a global soft power media holographic reality generation creation. And Russia just hasn't done that to maybe within 1/10 or 1/20 of that effort. But there are many things about internal Russian economy that are worth considering when you look at some of the questions that we'll be answering from you guys. But first, we're going to just look at the situation. So looking at the map, in Area 1, Kiev, a couple of things are happening at the same time. So the Ukrainians mounted some kind of counteroffensive south of Kiev that goes in two directions, because they have to cross the Dnieper going east, north by northeast, and then directly north. And from this map, the line of contact hasn't moved. But Kiev government, which we say Warsaw, has effectively established a perimeter, a solid line of defense at the line of contact. So that line of contact wouldn't move, and they've dug in there. So that'll probably look the same for another 5 to 7 days. But at the same time, and this is very interesting, at the same time, on the other side of Kiev, on the eastern side, it's a different story. There you have the forces, Russian forces, actually pushing south onto the entrenched and defended line of contact established by the Ukrainian forces. So that's why you hear mixed reports, because on the one hand, there were a lot of units that were not even operationalized, that were brought in through Belarus, that had the potential to wreak havoc on Kiev, and they were actually not really used. Whole, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mechanized units were brought in, and they were never used. But moving them in, because of the way that the information from the satellite or drone intel forced the Ukrainian army to dedicate a lot of their forces to Kiev, which kept them from being able to break the siege of Mariupol. And Mariupol has all but fallen. It's fallen. It's been done for a week. You've got a few hundred people hold up, Azov hold up here and there. I mean, they have great positions, but they've got to be hungry. Who knows? I mean, they probably picked up all kinds of food from civilians, but they've got to be filthy. They're not happy. They know they're done for. There's been several attempts to airlift out the command. The rest of them were given orders never to surrender. So that's what's going to happen there. Mariupol looks like a nightmare. It looks like Idlib. It looks like Aleppo in Syria. And it's very interesting on the information war. I'm a realist, as you know, with this stuff. And you can see that Ukraine has been promoting a lot of the imagery of the destruction. And so what has Russian media done? Well, they've used some of the Azov drone stuff, and they've said, like, yeah, this is what we'll do. It's pretty ugly, huh? That's the truth. They're like, yep, we did this. This is, who wants the next city to look like this? That's just the truth of it. And I'm not saying it could have gone, I'm not saying they went heavier. There could have been an easier way. They actually went very light. The whole length of the blockade and the siege was to evacuate civilians, but the physical infrastructure in so many parts of the city is toast. You can see it. But it's a city of 500,000. There's areas that are not that messed up. But from the areas that you can see as far as the eye can see from a drone, it's like, it looks definitely post-apocalyptic. Those shots that we just shared, right along the coastline, on the Black Sea, the Sea of Azov. It's like apocalypse on the seaside. So the general idea has been to create lots of possibilities. And, you know, everything's in real time, okay? And the Ukrainian army could have, there's no way to call that type of bluff. Because it's not a bluff, it's a real threat. If they moved all their forces in to the Donbas, to reinforce Kharkov more, or even to try to take Donetsk, to fight off the, looks like, from about a third of Lugansk and about 40% of Donetsk that had been under pro-Russian hands for the past 8 years, it's now like 80% are in the pro-Russian hands of the Republican forces, formerly of the former Ukraine. And had they moved all those forces over there to the east, then they could have surrounded Kiev and done things there, or to Odessa, and you had the Navy there. It wasn't a fake out. It's just you can predict what they're going to do, but you're actually pinning them down. It's not like you can call that type of bluff, because if you do move, then you actually do take Odessa or you do take Kiev. Do you see how that works? There's any number of ways it could have flowed. So people saying that the original plan was to take Kiev quickly and blah, blah, blah. I don't care if they're Russian or if they served in Chechnya or if they wax their mustache or like to do World War I historical reenactments, I don't give a fuck. When someone in information war, I'm qualified to detect this. If every single thing they fucking say is mirror image from Western MSM talking points, then I know that they're compromised, period. There's really nothing else. I mean, maybe they're part of a limited hangout, or they're okay, maybe they're doing like triple agent stuff, okay, fine, but at face value what the guy is saying is bullshit. It's just not how plans work. It would have been silly to think that Kiev would have allowed Kiev to be taken in order to reinforce the far east of the country. It just doesn't make sense. What the Russian Ministry of Defense announced yesterday is what we had been saying on this channel for quite some time. Is that phase one involved pinning them down. That, think about the balance of forces. I don't have a good read on the number of Russian forces on the ground, and then you have Chechens and so on, but you have some Ossetians but maybe it's 80,000 up to 200,000. I would think closer to 100,000. I've heard people say that Scott Ritter floated 200,000. I think that Ukraine is not fielding 600,000, but I do think that they're fielding 350,000, 400,000, but not 600,000. They're maybe, but they, well, this is what they did. See, the British agreed and the Americans agreed to get Ukraine quickly up to the force potential status required for Ukraine to be a NATO country. It's different for every country. Ukraine is very big, and they're right on the, they have a very large border with Russia. So Ukraine would have to be the largest, closest and largest and best European army of NATO to be a NATO country, to not be, to add to the force potential and not be a liability. That's why one of the aims of this conflict from Russia's perspective is to degrade Ukraine's force potential. Now, if you looked at these numbers 2 years ago, you would have seen that their standing army had like 150,000 with like 100,000 reserves. And then they just ballooned in 2 years to like 225,000 with 900,000 reserves. And that, to me, it just doesn't sound like how that works. Now, wars are won, wars of attrition and conventional wars of this scale are won by reserves. It's not as much the quality of your first army, but the quality and time it takes to raise your second army, your third army, and so forth. That's how Napoleon had systematized the reserve system. When he was up against, you know, Prussian, et cetera, it wasn't that these were weaker forces. It's that these were wars of attrition. And so when the numbers eroded, you don't have to win the battles. You have to win the game of numbers. So when Ukraine says 900,000, that to me sounds very much like that's basically men between the ages of 18 and 35, let's say, or maybe 40, who had 2 years of mandatory military service, non-combat, but just training, live in a barracks, know how to live, shoot, know what the basics are, for 2 years, maybe a year. And then after that, so then they're 20 years old, let's say, and they're done with that obligation. And then they're considered part of the reserves for the next, you know, 15 or 20 years to be called up in such a situation as part of a draft. I don't think that Ukraine had the potential to call up that number of people and to put that on paper as 900,000 unless they changed, just played word games and changed the meaning of military from of a reserve from potential to be conscripted into reserve. That's just my read on it. So it's a very different situation. I mean, they were letting people out of jail. And, you know, obviously part of that it might have been some tactics to create mayhem and increase mayhem. But, you know, that doesn't make complete sense. There's many dimensions to this, of course. But at any rate, I would say that the Russian forces outnumbered 3-1, 3.5-1, maybe 4-1. And I think those are the same ratios being bounced out there. I just think the numbers are half all around. That's just my sense of it. It would take another 20 minutes that we're not dedicated to deconstruct that. And I don't think it's the most interesting point, because what we see doesn't change in terms of the outcomes of this. It does mean that Russia has a lot more headroom, and Ukraine does not have much more headroom. Now, I don't really look too much at the numbers reported by either side, because there's too much politics involved in that. And I don't know, you know, numbers get fudged a lot. They might report deaths, but maybe that's some people who died on the battlefield, but they won't count it as a death if they died, if they had them on life support and they died a week later. Or they have traumatic brain injury and they're in a coma and they're having them on life support or whatever. You know, there's too many ways that these numbers get fudged. The conflict is too early on to have a real sense of the numbers. There's too many bureaucratic ways to play with numbers, and, you know, hospitals and militaries or bureaucracies, and they have goals. And I'm not saying it's wrong. This is just reality. So I don't look at those numbers. However, you can see on the map that the French provide that the conflict is going to focus on the Donbas. Mariupol is, I guess you can call that liberated. I would call it demolished. But yeah, you can see that Ukraine established a buffer line southwest of Kiev. The Russian forces from Chernigov pushed towards the Dnieper from east of Kiev. The Russian detachment force from the west of Kiev, that's the group that was never actually operationalized. They were brought in as if they were not used there. They were in operations, but they were not firing on objects. Does that make sense? There were hundreds and hundreds of these things, mechanized artillery, and they moved them out into Belarus and then over to come in through the Russian border. Maybe through by Sumy or even Kharkov through Russia, just sort of brought over up and then over to the right, which is like on a map, east and then south into either Kharkiv or this big fight. It looks like it's going down Kramatorsk or Izium. RIA says it looks like it's Izium. But this is 2 days ago. But that's why what we're talking about is accurate. Everything else is basically fog of war, rumors, or I know a guy who's a field commander, he says we're moving here. A lot of times field commanders say where they're going is not where they're fucking going, because lots of loose lips, lots of people with their whatever, their phones, and say, hey, we're going here. You know, so just, you always give it a couple days. So yeah, you have that Russian detachment force move to Belarus and then over to Kharkiv or Izium. And then Russian forces from the Kharkov region and Lugansk and Donetsk are also all pushing at the same time into either Izium or Kramatorsk. That's the idea there. And then in the south, the forces that were used in the south, Mariupol are pushing north. And that might be, again, just a necessary draw for the force of the Ukrainian forces that are there, draw them away from the main goals. But again, if they don't pay attention to that, then the goals change. It's all contingency. It's all water. It's flowing in real time. So it's not like you can't call bluffs. They're not putting fake tanks there, fake armies there. You understand what's going on here? It's all real potential. And then it looks like, at least as of a couple days ago, Ukrainian forces launched some counterattacks to push from Kryvyi to the line of contact south in central southern Ukraine. And also Ukrainian forces in the Odessa region. I guess they're taking a risk and leaving Odessa open for a naval attack, or maybe they've gotten some assurances about naval things. There's so many layers, of course. But it looks like they're trying to fight for Nikolaev. So that's what it looks like. And so look at the map that we took earlier today from the French Ministry of the Army. And you'll see that's what you're looking at. And so I don't look at where, you know, the lines, where the shaded areas are, because that's just kind of general zone of control or zones of conflict. But it's really more interesting to see where the movements are happening and what the French reconnaissance is showing the movements. They were fairly reliable in the Syrian conflict too. So now I'm going to look at your questions. I think we've already taken very good questions in terms of the ones that are written here. Aaron Tullius asks, what are your thoughts on whether shortages are real or manufactured as per Schwab's prediction? Or is it just to blame Russia? What's the relationship there? In the U.S., this is, we've talked about this at length, but it's okay to answer briefly. Thank you, Aaron. A lot of this stuff is imaginary in the U.S. The issue is the velocity of money and all the debate, the currency debasement. Something like 70 or 80% of all the U.S. dollars in circulation were, you know, printed, like quote unquote printed, added to a computer screen in the last couple of years. That's insane. That's insane. So that would cause, but that doesn't cause the inflation itself as long as it sits. You know, when it first happened and they first did it, it was given over to these very big companies and it was used to prop up the stock market. But they just kept them in their banks, so it's not circulating. And if money has to circulate for, you know, the rate of circulation is the velocity of money. If it doesn't circulate, there's no velocity. If it's not moving, there's no right velocity movement. There's no movement, no inflation. I mean, it's latent, it's potential inflation, and then that's what you're seeing. But if there are not things to buy on shelves, or there's limits, you might not see it because a bunch of individual anecdotes of, oh, I went to here to buy this and I didn't see it, or someone filming shelves at a store that are empty. You can still get things, but consumer psychology is complex. And just because you can go find it somewhere else doesn't mean the next person, so other people buy thing, might have bought the same thing for a different reason from you. And it was just, if it's just 5 miles out of the way, they're not going to buy it. And you take that aggregated over a whole economy and it adds up tremendously to many less purchases. And so it has an effect on the velocity of money and it puts a control on the rate of inflation. But the gas in the US they could turn on. That's a question of what we do with Texas. This has to do with how the combination of regulation, international agreements, and some of the mythology around peak oil have all contributed to the public accepting high gas prices. The high gas prices are part of the manufacturing of that because that's a single purchase. It goes right, you know, of course you have a bunch of small gas stations or vendors, et cetera, but they just take pennies off of a gallon. And it goes back to the same holding and then it sits there. And then they don't, it doesn't circulate from there. And it takes money out of the economy that you would have spent on a lot of other things. So it's, again, spending money on gas, the way I see it, I haven't put pen to paper on it, but if just visually you can visualize that if it's the one purchase and there's only a few gas companies, like gasoline. So the mom and pops, you might own a franchise or whatever, but you only get a couple cents off a gallon. And everything else is going to these big companies, and then they keep it on their balances, and it, you know, it's not circulating per se. They're doing weird things to keep money from flowing. And if you're spending a lot on gas, then you're also not buying other things. And it also limits the movement of goods. So the gas price is actually a big controller on all these other things, like the artificial scarcity. So it's all connected to, I think, the debasement of the currency. Yeah. There's no real relation to Russia with what's going on in the US is, you know, anything else I would have to like work through and crunch through and put pen to paper, kind of logic it out, would be, you know, fine. But what's evident anyway, like you could be blind and still see it, is that what's happening with Russia has no bearing on what your prices are in the US. Now, of course, these are all related things, related to the Great Reset and related to the collapse of the New World Order, which has been defeated. It's just, this is painful. And wars happen when paradigms shift. They're pain. It's like the birth pains of a new world type of thing. So it's very, very complicated. I don't want to get into talking about currency and metals and stuff. It's number one, not my expertise. I'm not that interested in money, never have been. I believe you need food and understand belief systems and people. That's going to be much more important. If understanding belief systems and being able to assess human behavior and having a strong reputation of credibility and trust in communities is going to be a far greater asset than how much stuff you're trying to hide from your neighbors that have guns. Do you understand me? Yeah. So everything else is just like people still thinking like merchants while Rome burns. Yeah, you can like some arbitrage here and make some more imaginary money, but you can't eat money. When the excrement really hits the propeller, people hand over like thousands of dollars for hundreds of dollars of food in the black market. It's like prison. Like cigarettes is like $50 worth of blowjobs. Is this making sense? If you're really talking about where, oh, what are the shortages are gonna, either it's gonna be within what the bottom 20% of the population or 10% of the population can afford, or you're going to have a breakdown in order. I'm going to go to look at the questions more relating to Ukraine and the conflict. So, Persistent Tiger asks, what do you think Russia is planning for Western Ukraine? Yeah, we've discussed this one a lot, but it's okay because we always have, you know, new listeners, and we can just touch that in 3 minutes, less, 30 seconds, I think. There's many different possibilities. Certainly, Western Ukraine, what we can tell, because you can tease out truths from the statements that actually occur after these failed talks. And that's what I've said. I've said these talks don't produce results, but they do produce statements from which you can actually tease out the real positions. It's sort of like price discovery. but it's actually reality discovery. And the reality discovery that happens through these talks is this. Zelensky, his handlers will not allow any peace, period. That's it. The things that he says he's open to in the media, that asterisk mark, when you read that fine print, it's neutrality will be a referendum question once the Russian army leaves the country. Right. Yeah. So then if that's a non-starter, because that would require a constitutional change. But this is a country that twice violated its own constitution because of George Soros' color revolutions. So this is, I'm going to use in layman's terms, and I'm not, okay, this is an occupation. And the new state, meaning the constitutional order, is going to be reconstructed by Russia while the Russian army is there. That's what is being said. If you, you know, it's like you have an object on a piece of paper, and yet you can only describe the object so much without referencing what it's contrasting up against the piece of paper. So I'm outlining that piece of paper that it sits on. So through those statements, those objects sitting on the paper, I'm describing how you can tell the difference between that object and the paper. So if the Russian army leaving for them to rewrite their constitution and hold new elections and a referendum is a non-starter for Russia, then that means that Ukraine has to be under Russian occupation while it recreates its state institutions. That's denazification. So it can't just be, you know, we swear, but we're going to have our fingers crossed behind our backs, and then as soon as you leave, NATO's going to bring in nuclear missiles. Like, that just, it just doesn't make sense. At this cost, so, Crypt asks, I have a good question. Okay. Does Putin stand and retaliate against the liberal hegemonic worldview on the West as being posed upon? I've noticed a lot of right-wingers make this counter-argument, especially the fascists and that. Well, I don't give a fuck what fascists and national socialists think, Nazis. I really don't care what their arguments are, because they're an insignificant constituency in America. And I'm mostly interested in speaking to Americans. Our problem is with technocrats, grifters, politicians, and the oligarchy. We don't have like a big Nazi or fascist movement, except maybe ones that call themselves anti-fascist, frankly. So public relations is how you frame things. And retaliation is outside of that perspective, and so is international relations. Diplomacy is not about retaliation. So within your question is actually the implicit value assumption that retaliating is what one wants to do. And that's having your opponent control your actions. In other words, if I can provoke you to do things, then I'm calling the timing, and I'm calling the set of possible potential set of your reactions. And no one intelligent operates that way in the world. But the very good part of your question about the liberal hegemonic worldview, that's very much what you see happening. The liberal hegemonic worldview is the soft power component, and it's a good question, Trip, thank you, is the soft power component of the so-called international community, which we talked about before, and that's just basically Western European countries, the United States, Canada, the UK and the former Commonwealth, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, we said that, the US, that's it, Japan, Israel, that's it. That's the international community. And yeah, that whole, you know, Coca-Cola, Disneyland, CNN universe, liberal hegemony is obviously not appealing to, it's appealing to people who are aspirations of, you know, to think like if you're from Mali, soft power is like the dream, the center of the world is Paris. You see what I'm saying? And for a lot of people in India, now, not most, and it's changed a lot. But 100 years ago in India, if you were from the upper middle class, the center of the world was London. And you might have your, you might be very proud as an Indian, et cetera, and, but having an education from Oxford or Cambridge and having lived 10 years, maybe worked for some British concern there, and then coming back to India, you're like, well, you're basically English at that point, aren't you? That's soft power, in that sense of soft power. Media projects another level of soft power, operating at another level, mass media. And it's clear that Russia has a policy of constructing their social mores, because social mores and values are social constructions, which doesn't make them any less real. It just understand that these can be manufactured. It just takes decades and not days. You can see that Russia has redefined things. I'm going to expand a little bit on this because it's worth pivoting. The main threats that faced Russia in the collapse of the Soviet Union were that they had a one-party state that were communists, which means that the West was able to operationalize ultra-traditional conservatives that were anti-communists, like monarchists, ultra-hedonistic, bohemian, you know, people in Moscow and St. Petersburg that thought that New York City was the center of the world, like that kind of soft power, but very liberal, very, you know, orgies and, you know, I want to open an art studio and sleep until 2 o'clock, smoking cigarettes, drinking vodka, boy toys, that. And then you had the, you know, neo-Nazi thing, subculture that was being propagated through Western European youth culture, skinhead stuff, gothic skinhead, and a type of weird thing that only occurred in some parts of the post-communist world because they already had a communist government in power. So a lot of hippies, you had liberal hippies and then you had Nazi hippies. I know it's kind of weird to think of that because, you know, like in the Western countries, you have liberal hippies and then you have like Marxist and communist hippies, right? And in Russia and in the former, in that, the culture is different because they had to be in opposition, right, to be against the system wasn't so much. There were some small groups that were like, we want a true communist government, not the, you know, not Gorbachev or not whatever, these guys before. But that was smaller. The real thing, the milieu was liberal hippies and then Nazi hippies. And then the thing is that there's a fusion. You have like liberal Nazi hippies and liberal Nazi artistic bohemian dilettantes. And then you have rural Nazis. And then you have kind of people that are maybe monarchist traditionalists and Nazis. So anyway, but the biggest main vector of normal people in post-Soviet Russia were westernizers and modernizers. So what Russia had to do within the framework of what they called sovereign democracy was to split, like electorally and culturally split, the idea of modernization, like, you know, that it can look like the West in terms of skyscrapers and lights. And like, if you looked at Moscow at night in the 70s or 80s and Paris at night in the 70s and 80s look totally different. Like, there's way more electricity and neon lights and life at night, like in Paris, right? So think about that. That's modernized. You don't have to have the value set. That's westernization. You don't have to have the belief system that goes along with that, of what you see. So in Russia, what Putin was able to bring together was to reject the liberal cultural hegemony and redefine the modernizers separately from the westernizers. And then also give the kind of monarchist traditionalists, because there was always these sections of a kind of a offbeat group in Russian society that were kind of like, in a sense, like monarchists, in a sense, but more just romanticists about 19th century Russia. Like, this was, you know, dignified. And so they're also against the liberal Western cultural hegemony of modernity in terms of popular culture and mass culture, because they're a little bit more, you know, aristocratic in their tastes. So all these different groups of people had to be redefined and kind of brought in, and basically in the same way that you might nationalize the oligarchy to make them tycoons, you had to make the small group of, you know, Nazi hippies, make them more just like Russian esotericists and pagan, you know, into Russian deep history. Like, you know, what was Russia doing in the 6th century AD? Like, people into that, and what were, you know, what were our gods, Perun, and, you know, what were the equivalent to the Viking, like, gods, and what was the indigenous, you know? So you do see some of that with, like, the old Sun Wheel stuff and all of that Russian mysticism. But that was a project of the Russian intelligence to split and break off and isolate that from the smaller group of degenerate, like Adolf Hitler, Western Nazi thing. Because kind of like the esoteric far right was a branch, actually. I know it's hard to realize if you're from the West, but it was a branch of the metropolitan, you know, metropolitan urban dilettante kind of intellectuals and bohemians. So all of these things have involved in all these different things that you see in Russia today. And then, of course, you have the legacy that the parts that they're proud of from the Soviet period, like World War II, and a lot of things that function in that society better than not having it, like healthcare and pensions, especially with people when you get to a certain age and, you know, your health betrays you, you start to appreciate these things. So retired people and older people appreciate that. And also because Russia's geopolitical position that they're trying to preserve in the balance of power is the post-World War II order, not the post-Cold War order, because that's what we talked about before. That's the first is international law, which is where the only real agreements exist. And the second is the rules-based system that the U.S. and the Western NATO countries started to try to unilaterally implement after the Cold War, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So that's why you see a lot of kind of Soviet nostalgia. So that all has to be woven into this very colorful tapestry of different themes that make up the kind of Russian culture production. Now, that said, That said, a lot of Russians are just people living their lives and their kids watch, you know, music videos and text with their boyfriends on the phone or whatever. They're just kids and young people and just, oh, I need to get a job. And what am I going to go to school, study, you know, whatever, engineering, IT, farming. I'm going to be a cop, whatever. It's like, see, most people just live their lives, but you're talking about liberal hegemony and cultural production. So it's a small group of people that get involved in that. But those are the ideas that form modern Russia. Thank you for that question. Sherilyn asks, what about this info on the aerosol bioweapons? Kadyrov said in his address that it was going to take out an entire continent. The story should be massive. I think it could be massive. I mean, if you spread it, if you share it, you know, it will blow up. It's a pretty big story. We live in these echo chambers in Western countries. This is giant news in a lot of countries. A lot of countries that actually respect when the Russian foreign minister or ministry of defense says, we have made concrete conclusions about biological weapons. So it was revealed to yesterday that it was that they bought Turkish drones and they were going to do chemtrails from unmanned aerial vehicles carrying, like 5 gallons. So it's maybe not as big, but 5 gallons each, and to spread contagious pathogens by air into Russia. Pretty crazy. They were studying viruses that transmit from bats to humans and also the standard avian flu, like from birds to humans. And that's all, now that we're at this awakening, we start using words like, well, this was gain of function research. So they're going to say it's not bioweapons because they were studying just how, but now we know that bioweapons projects on the documents don't say bioweapons. In the write-up, it's talking about what functions they're going to add, like it's gain of function. That's a bioweapon. So in terms of enhancing the contagiousness or deadliness or shortening the incubation period or lengthening the incubation period, probably be more contagious, in fact, of different contagious pathogens. Yeah. So that's very big stuff that popped like yesterday, today, just, you know, hitting the news cycle. And so, you know, if they're smart, they'll pop that off again on Monday. They'll have to keep, you know, because that's like another news cycle. And I think they just keep revealing it. The way they're doing it is they're kind of revealing it in chapters. We first started hearing about this like a month ago, bioweapons. Wow, the bioweapons labs. I mean, you know, the public. Me and my colleagues have been looking at this since at least 2012, but that's just from our perspective. But it's been known about, I think, since 2005. Slowly, just what's going on. Okay, I'm on questions. These have been very good questions. I want to thank everybody. Lydia Stano asks, you've been talking yesterday about false dichotomies in language. Do you have recommendation how to spot them easily? Yeah, sure. These are, first of all, euphemisms. People argue euphemisms all the time. Well, we just mentioned one, bioweapons. And then, you know, you're talking to someone and saying, oh, no, they were just studying how they work. And then you go, right, they were also studying how to expand their ability to work. And that's what a bioweapon is. False dichotomies in language, or how they're rewriting the dictionary, you will see it all the time if through that lens. Just look at the word that they use and then think about what it really means, like build back better. And if you're going build back from what? Well, as I've said, this killer thing that people are taking was long ago researched in all likelihood. Its effects were already known. That was the one that was going to roll out. Somebody forced it to come out much sooner. The real, what you're really building back from was a 4 or 5 year lockdown. Then people would have been clamoring for that. I'm not going to talk too much about the subject because it's sensitive. We're live. I'm monitored a lot. I'm not a doctor. These are just opinions of one man. Nothing I say is authoritative. This is for entertainment purposes only, as we say, as our disclaimer says at the top of the channel. This is just one man's opinion. Sometimes we engage in parody. You follow me? So people are asking, there's a lot of, you know, what is going on with this rubles for gas system? Okay. Number one, of course, it reinforces the ruble, but equally as important, obviously they have to pay with something. If they're going to pay with rubles, they have to buy rubles, don't they? So what do they buy the rubles with? Well, they're buying the rubles with their money, with euros. Does that make sense? Now, what happened when this whole thing popped off? Okay, is that Russia had its foreign accounts seized. And the way to understand it is that there's two types of major crises that happen in the world that are not from natural disasters. Okay, there's economic crises, and there's geopolitical crises. And in terms of economic crises, like what was seen in 2008 and 2019 and so forth, it's the better option of other options for a country like Russia to have your foreign currency reserves not held in your own country, because that's like not having them. So then when 300 or whatever, 300 billion was seized, now the euros that can go into a Russian bank like the Gazprom bank that's not under sanctions, interestingly, those euros are not going to be digital euros. They're not going to be accounting euros. But I know this is going to sound funny. Physical paper. The physical paper. That's the mechanism. They want the physical paper euros in Russia at a bank that's 49.5% or something owned by the Russian government. Then they will keep those euros like that. turn those into rubles at an exchange rate that's within reason, but also favors Russia, but also it favors you if you're the one getting the ruble value, because you want as much value for the ruble as possible. So it sets the ruble and euro together in such a way that it helps the euro not be sabotaged by whatever sabotage of the games from the dollar and from the transatlanticists trying to damage the euro. Russia can rebuild its foreign currency reserves and do it and have them for the war period in the country, and then it can move them back on a new agreement with the once Ukraine is settled. There's just many possibilities like this. And you might not, and you won't necessarily then therefore need a rubles scheme in place forever. And likewise, today is the day that the law goes into effect. But of course you have contracts in existence that have to be honored, and there has to be a way to phase in doing that. But the announcements and the existence of the law and the chatter around it and all of the possible outcomes have in and of themselves, because it's speculative, have created value today in the ruble, which has rebounded by a lot. Does that make sense? So that's how I would look at it. You see, Russia's foreign exchange reserves had to be held abroad. And there was nothing they could have done in terms of the war that would have avoided the Western countries freezing their euro and dollar assets. So if you go to the Russian Central Bank website, they have like their kind of breakdown analysis of it, they explain it. It was earlier in March that I guess it was not 300 billion. It was like 140 something billion worth of their foreign exchange reserves were seized under the sanctions imposed by the US and EU in response to the military operation. But their way out of it and what they've done to strengthen the ruble and continue avenues of method of payment, which reinforce the ruble, works against how things worked 100 years ago, where being at war with a country meant you weren't really trading with them. I mean, it's really, the war is not with Ukraine. This is a geopolitical struggle with a military component. But it's with transatlanticism, which is the mechanism that ties the US to Europe. Despite that, new technologies like super fast rail and energy needs make Russia and Europe more reasonable to have the closer relationship. Think about how much the US could do to invest in Mexico instead of worrying about Russia's relationship with Ukraine or Europe. Think about the economic renaissance that could happen if the U.S. invested in Mexico in a way that made sense to Mexico, not like having a puppet Mexican president, but a sovereign Mexico making deals in its own interest, that investment, you could, Mexico's economy, Mexicans would create so much wealth and industry in Mexico. Number one, you'd eliminate the immigration crisis because Mexicans would want to stay in Mexico. It'd be wealthier, cleaner, safer, employed. The United States could build up, could use a lot of its tremendous resources and continue to reinforce its own wealth and power along the way as a land power in North America, which, by the way, North America goes all the way south to Central America. That's all North America. That's the continent. The term Central America and Latin America are more like cultural terms, regions like the Balkans or Western Europe. They're like specific. They're not a continent. But North America could be integrated. We talk about things like just-in-time production as a phasing into more localized 3D printing. That's the way you want to do it. You know, if I were president for 8 years, these are the things that I would work with the Senate and Congress to get done. I would abolish the CIA. I would end NATO. I would completely transform the UN or pull out of the UN or get back to basics with the UN. Really the same thing. The solutions are much simpler. The problem is the political process. The problem is that we have an institutional power in place in the West for almost 400 years. And there have been moments of rebellion and attempts that succeeded for times at what Pareto calls a rotation or circulation of elites. In layman's terms, you might even call it a revolution. There was the American Revolution, etc. But really, for 400 years, you've had a way of thinking about money and a way of thinking about human beings' relationship to that. And then for 200 years, there's been a very, or 250 years, has been a very specific attitude towards Russia, at least, yeah, around there. And those have just grown institutionally. But you'd have to be, as we said, in the 18th and 19th century, those who owned the ocean owned the world. And that was true in the 16th and 17th century, too. You had the Portuguese Empire, the Spanish Empire, the British Empire. You know, of course, you had the Dutch, a little more mercantile, but no less greedy. But the Anglo-Dutch world that grew out of the Spanish-Portuguese system that they sort of inherited or they built up in different regions, but very similar methods. The Spanish and the Portuguese in South Asia and Africa and Latin America, and the Anglo-Dutch in also in the South Asia with the Dutch and North America and Oceania. But is this way of thinking about power in the world and the money and how things work in that, you know, there was an attempt after, well, with the Bretton Woods Agreement to rethink those things, but the British derailed the point of Bretton Woods. And so even though we got a Bretton Woods Agreement, the outcome of it was very different from what could have been possible. But it's a movement. Bretton Woods, even on this Keynesian model, in many ways was a step in the right direction, because for the first time, people could see that at a certain point you get to such levels of automation that the human labor component is less and less necessary, all things being equal. Now, there's different arguments about what people are freed up to do and how what new innovations might create new markets. And some of it is fictional, and there's some points there. The question is, in the final analysis, at a certain point, almost everything can be automated. And even though there may still be jobs for certain people to do, you have 8 or 9 billion people, you see. Now, from the point of view of the World Economic Forum, that means that, you know, 7 billion people should die or stop reproducing or die out. Or, you know, there's maybe what they debate is, should we be humane and just make them infertile? Or should we, like, pay more homage to Moloch and, you know, use war and famine and things that are kind of exciting to see, because we never get to see that. Imagine like a kid playing with an anthill. Does he just cover the top with sand and try to fill it in, or does he pour water on it, see them all drown it? There's different ways to do it. That's how they see us. That's why during the lockdown, the World Economic Forum was publishing on their Twitter all these beautiful pictures of Paris and London without people. Isn't it beautiful how tranquil? Look at that. So peaceful without human beings. Everything is so still. And they want you to think, wow, just for me to walk. No, you're one of the dead ones, fucker. Not for you to walk through the streets alone. You're the reason that they can walk through the streets alone. So, but on the question of that, of the currency and Russia's approach, we explain that there are two types of financial crises. You have the traditional ones like 2008, 2014, 2020. And there's geopolitical ones. And you want it, and money works in different ways in those types of situations. So I haven't seen Peskov's statement in answer to that question, if they'll go off of the ruble's requirement. But just ignore counter news. Like, for the love of Christ, the law went into effect today. And now people are talking about, oh, it's going to... Stop reacting. Number one, stop reacting. Just take things as like water off your back, just like a duck, right? Stop reacting. Just treat things as, okay, that's interesting. Maybe there's some logic or reason to that after all. They certainly built up and wound up this whole thing. I don't think they're pulling the plug on it on the day that it starts as a law to go into effect. And that is with new contracts. And with existing contracts, that's more flexible because of the language of the contract. And it has to be in the currency value, and they can probably pay, have a reasonable expectation that they're paying in the currency of the currency value. At least, I mean, how else does a European, they don't, you know, they don't have rubles to buy rubles. I mean, it's just, you just have to use your head. What would they buy rubles with? Gold? Well, that's a possibility, but I think that gold works differently. And I don't think that there was an expectation that they were going to have trainloads of gold going into Moscow from Berlin. The last time they did that is when the Germans sent Lenin in. So but during a geopolitical crisis, Russia needs alternative assets like gold that are immune to sanctions. You see, so in a traditional crisis, the US dollar and euro reserves that were held outside of the country, held outside of the country, would help the country pay off its debt to keep trade going. And so therefore, the necessity to have those out there means that in a war situation, nothing can be done to prevent an asset freeze. Cashless currencies are always booked on correspondent accounts with foreign banks. And of course, they can be frozen. So there went $150 billion, like up in smoke. And as we said, during a geopolitical crisis, they need alternative assets, and gold is one of them. But so is the Chinese yuan. Those are also immune to Western sanctions for reasons we know. And so Russia had actually been building up its gold and its yuan for a number of years. And actually had accounted for about half of its foreign exchange reserves. So now the Russian Ministry of Finance says that Russia has reserves over 600 billion, maybe 700 billion. And about 300 billion were frozen. Okay. And half of that were seized under sanctions. But Moscow knew that that would happen, but they're pretending that they couldn't have foreseen that development as part of their leverage in response to creating this ruble scheme, because they actually turned chaos and a crisis into an ability to climb the ladder. I hope this all makes sense. Let me know in your comments if it's making sense. Now, people I'm looking at questions. Yeah. So Kendall is saying pensions are really low in here, though. Healthcare is all right, but many hospitals need to be repaired, blah, blah, blah. You've never lived in the United States, so you don't understand what you're comparing it to. You see, having a low grade, dilapidated public healthcare system as an option for those in need creates pressure on what should also be a dual system of a private healthcare system. So if you don't have a public system at all, then the prices of private healthcare just go up to whatever limit. That what they do is they say, what is the income of what is the median income? And then what is the median income's money after their mortgage and another couple hundred dollars, and let's take all of that. Okay. So 800 a month, 1,000 a month, and then plus, since you have credit cards, then they're going to say, and there's a $4,000, $5,000 deductible, and there's a $5,000 copay. So you actually have to spend $10,000 on a thing that they're going to charge $50,000 for. But if you had a public option, it would actually be included in that public option. And so the thing is that the existence of that public option brings down the price of the private option down by tenfold or more. So that's the economics of it. You can't be ideological. People who think the markets are going to solve it, well, then you get monopolies, because that's reality, because people also have guns and force and coercion and corruption. Okay, and then if you just have a public system, it's going to be an unchecked bureaucracy that just operates in its own self-interest. You need both systems to compete and work in different ways for different demographics, but yet they have upward and downward. They have an upward quality pressure. It has an upward quality pressure on the public sector, and it and the same relationship has a downward price pressure on the private sector. So I don't listen to people that live in countries that have both options and then complain about the public option, because you don't understand why the public option is there. So that's how to approach that. Now, Kostadin 9 is asking, you're right about Russia knew how the reaction of the West would be, but tell me, how do you explain the suicidal moves from the EU? EU is deindustrializing. Yeah, that's... Well, if I say that's the Great Reset, then you're going to think, well, that was all their plan. No, that's all their fucking loss. They're losing. And the way that psychopaths frame losing is winning. They have so much skin in game. Just like we explained, I'll just make it's not the best analogy, but it's the one we just explained. Just like we explained how the chatter and moves and declaration about putting a gold floor to the ruble and demanding payments in rubles, just as that alone caused the ruble value to increase. You see, it's what we think is supposed to happen. It's in our minds. It's subjective. The value is, the speculative value is a creation in our minds. It's like collective psychosis in a sense. It's like mass hallucination in a sense, okay? The Western economic order knows that the natural evolution of Europe and Russia is to merge into a single economic zone. Now, the cultural, political, territorial, whatever, legislative stuff will kind of follow that. And it can happen in different ways. You know, once that is like stable, maybe you could have the republics in Russia have more independence, just as the countries of Europe would have more independence from the cabal. At that point, it would be very different, because you would build more trains, rail, energy. See, a lot of this nonsense that we're on about is coming from a couple of things. One is, and it was hard for people to hear, but the dangers of nuclear power have the anti-nuclear movements and the NGOs behind them, even though the concerns are legitimate. And of course, corporations cut corners and they make things as cheaply as possible and they bribe regulators or they lobby for regulate. Okay, right. We need more tip-top regulation and safety and remove some of the profit incentive in some way, or from things like long-term investments. We should treat nuclear power like roads. You know, it enables commerce to occur, but you don't have to treat the thing itself like as a commercial thing. You follow? So nuclear power, however, has gotten a far worse rap, in some ways deserved for reasons we just said, but also because the coal industry has given hundreds of millions of dollars to activists through NGOs to lobby against nuclear. And also, this whole thing with, and again, these are all just the opinions of one man. I say this for entertainment purposes only. Media matters. I'm just a guy. Don't pay attention to me. I have limited significance on this planet. Please go away. Don't bother me. When you actually look, at the amount of fuel that Russia has, I think already known, already there, that's not yet to be prospected. It's like that's what they know. And there's, you know, how deeper can they go with other places to look, et cetera, if the value went, if it went up to like, you know, higher price per cubic meter, but if it doubled, you know, then maybe it would make worth to invest in finding more, right? But right now, I think it's something like 200 years or 400 years. If they didn't find any more, they could fuel all of Europe and Russia for 400 years with what they have right now. And if you know, forgive me if that number is wrong, but it's something like that. It's not 20 years, okay? They're not running out. You get the idea? It's not 100 years. They're not running out. If someone says, hey, no, the number is 225 years, like, okay, sorry. But it's, I'm going to say 400 years, what I remember. And that's with growth. That's with growth. So if we can't figure out something that's going to work in 400 years, then maybe we don't deserve something better than that. I don't know. But I mean, 400 years is a long time to get it together. So, I mean, it's not, that's not like kicking the can down the road and, you know, it's not, that's not shifting the burden into the next generation. That's just like, we have lots of fuel. There's Texas, there's like Antarctica, there's so much so-called fossil fuels. They've made us think that we have to like rediscover Tesla stuff. And I'm not saying that, I'm not saying any of that is untrue. I'm sure that is also, I'm not an engineer. I'm not an electrician. I know a few things about that. There's a lot of damn fuel, like of fossil fuels, so-called fossil fuels under the earth, that there's no reason for anyone to be paying more than like 10 or 20 cents a gallon. Something like that. There's just not a reason for it. So you have to understand that the system that has been created for us in the Western world is very bizarre, and we've had unnecessary, excuse my cold, I'm very stuffed up. We've created artificial scarcity of the primary thing that creates the whole economy, energy. And so then everything else consequently is more expensive artificially. And then they make things to break. They've been writing about this for 70 years. The term is called planned obsolescence. See, they actually make things using parts that in some cases are more expensive. But they like using that plastic over, let's say, like a piece of tin, like in an appliance or a gadget, because they've studied the science of how many clicks or bends or times the button pushes on that piece of plastic that they can guarantee that it breaks after 45,000 touches. So you have to buy a new one. Even if you like take care of it and clean, oh, don't touch, don't drop, it's going to break after a certain number of touches. That's called planned obsolescence. They could actually use a cheaper material that was less designed to break, that is sturdier. And we could eliminate 90% of all non-perishable consumption, which would mean that we could either continue on with 9 billion people as if we had 1 billion people, or we could grow the population to 60 billion people or more with the same rate of consumption of manufactured goods. Consider that. So I don't think about overpopulation as one man's opinion. You see? So Lisa asks, there's a lot of infighting amongst truthers regarding germ versus terrain theory. Oh, I don't know. I don't know anything. I think that you probably, I mean, my hunch from my experience is that you get sick from both. I think that a lot of flu symptoms are from mold, and other things are, you're getting sick from like other people. Like if they have a bad immune system, and then like, then it probably builds up in high numbers in them. So then like you just, you know, get sick from them. But it's just, I don't have to read anything. You know, when you have children, you know that you're getting, you know, they're getting you sick, you're getting them sick. I'm sick right now. Nothing has changed in my environment. She was at school 2 weeks ago, got sick, very bad flu. And then I got sick. The diet hasn't changed. They didn't open up a new, like, smelting, like, factory, like next, nothing new like has happened. We don't have a new 5G tower or anything here. So it makes sense that there's communicable things and then there's environmental things for sure. Like why wouldn't it not be both, hypothetically, right? So great questions. I'm so not qualified to weigh in on 90% of them. I just, you know, they're good questions. And I just, you know, what is my random opinion? I'm looking at the questions. Okay, I'm only going to look for questions where I say live in 45 minutes. They don't turn off the pipeline today. Nothing is getting turned off. Russia doesn't want to disconnect from Europe. Atlanticist policy has been to provoke the resurrection of the Iron Curtain. Modern Russia doesn't agree, okay, with the transhumanist and neo-hedonistic turn that Western culture superimposed on top of modernization at some point in the late 90s. But there are reasons for that that are psychological operations, because those do, in their view, actually undermine society. That's not have anything to do with persecution of people of sexual preference or minorities, or, you know, there are things that are happening on a certain scale in Europe, in the US, which are by design. And many, many critics who are actually sympathetic to genuine crisis migrants, refugees, not choosing your sexual preference, it's, or your orientation or whatever. It's that's not the issue. And it's not illegal to be gay. There's like gay clubs in Moscow. They're not like the police don't come in and beat everybody up. It's about their legislation is about actually very, it's actually identical to what just happened in Florida. And I know like a lot of people are like, aha, so that proves that Rick DeSantis is a Putin dictator. No, it's just like if a kid's like under 8 years old or something, you can't be targeting things that promote sexual fetish in their view. It's not who it involves or that or whatever categories of people that you want to create, you know, out of that. I'm not of the view that you can even define people based on their preference / orientation. It's actually I see us. This is really about cultural hegemony. My own opinion is I see us in a course of development of awakening. And I think that when you look at the concept of homosexuality as a category of people, that was created, you know, 150, 100 years ago by people who ran mental health hospitals as a diagnosis. And I'm very much against most of that. The mental hospital system, shock therapy and lobotomies, was a way of systematizing dehumanization. And now what often happens when people are stigmatized is they begin to adapt the language or identity of their persecutors because that's what unites them in their opposition to persecution. But once you move past forward from the stage of liberation onwards, that identity should no longer have any meaning. Does that make sense? I'm of the view that Western societies went as far as society should have a voice to enforce or to, you know, promote tolerance and respect for all types of people on that subject of sexual orientation or preference. I think that by the late 90s or by the late 80s and early 90s, I think when the HIV/AIDS thing popped off and it was known that it greatly affected gay men more than other people, and yet people from all walks of life and many straight people, conservative people, all, you know, pitched in and wanted to, you know, overcome AIDS. And it was very little blaming gay people. It was like, this is an illness that needs to be. So that, and I remember all of that, you know, and now I think then because anything can divide people and because industries have their own momentum, like all these NGOs and stuff, like even though once you solve a problem that like we talked about before, like you have like these, let's say like a breast cancer NGO charity and it's bringing in $1 billion a year and we wear, you know, pink ribbons and stuff. And then they solve breast cancer, let's say. What's going to happen with that organization? Well, it's going to maybe might do something like it might redefine breast cancer to include ear cancer, foot cancer. You see, it might redefine it because you need to keep the machine. It's like a machine with a conscience of its own, has its own logic. It's going to demand that you redefine the word. And I think that homophobia has been redefined. I think that's what I think as a, you know, as one person with their opinion. So I've always been against persecution of people, period. Governments, employers should look at, are you good at what you do? Do you build a good team environment at work? Do customers like you? Are you on time? Do you smell good? Right? That's what matters. I think everyone agrees with that. But I think there's an industry that has built up that is redefining homophobia to be, if you're not homophilic, you're homophobic. So now I think that is living in former communist world here. That's how you see in the culture. That's what people are pushing back against. That's how they see is happening in the far West, is actually there's no elected leader of the gays. Okay. A lot of gay people in the West have no interest in the so-called gay agenda. Many are annoyed by it, openly so. They have their own internet, their own things they argue about. And it's these self-appointed people that get these George Soros monies that call themselves leaders of the LGBTQ whatever community that no one elected, just like BLM. No one elected them. Twitter decided who's the head of BLM. That's who became the head of BLM? Twitter, Jack Dorsey was the electoral committee and the ratification committee of the election of who's the head of BLM. It was Jack Dorsey. You just decided. That's how I understand the cultural divide. But other than that, Russia is like, yeah, you know, inventions are good, commerce is good, freedom is good, markets are good indicators for prices, private property is good, but monopolies are bad. I think those are the basic values that the European Union was founded on too. But you have these Sorosian cultural hegemonic projects that really went very hardcore in the 90s. Why? The Soviet Union collapsed, but it also transitioned. There were several things happening at once. It was also a pivot from within Russian power structures, understanding that by adapting the Western European model, that it would make peace and economic integration and mutual prosperity more viable. Who was against that? The transatlanticists, Soros, USAID, Radio Free Liberty, Radio Europe, the National Endowment for Democracy. So then they picked up, they started to put into high gear all of these things, which are actually quite off-putting for non-brainwashed people everywhere in the world. But because they couldn't control mass media and mass culture in Russia, this is what people are concerned about. Now, of course, you have ultra-conservatives and there's like ultra-conservative people in the post-comm. They're like, these girls should not be wearing miniskirts. Like, thank God they shave their legs and their underarms, dude. Like, their hair is not blue. Like, they're going out to a nightclub. They're going to meet a boy. They're going to give you grandchildren. Fucking relax. So, of course, there's like ultra-conservatives and stuff in every country. That's not Russia. That's not Poland. It's not the Balkans. Very lively, very, you know, young people party, there's a lot of freedom. In that sense, in that pre-2005, that pre-Obama definition of, you know, a healthy, vibrant, liberal, like in that sense, culture. That vibe, that vibration on the streets. So it's not like a cold, Russia's not a cold place in the winter. People, like, now you're seeing people for the first time are seeing all of these shots of Ukraine, and which is looks the same as Russia. Like, wow, it's like these green forests and these lakes. In the summer, people go on the beach. Wow, like in bikinis in Russia, like that's what? You didn't know that, did you? So they created this whole thing. They always like showed people wearing like these furry muffs and big furs because they always showed like, what does it look like in January? It's like, well, Wisconsin looks like that in January too, asshole. Anyway. A lot of these things are cultural constructs. Like whenever they like film the Mideast or Mexico, they put like this yellow filter over the lens so you think it's like destitute or dry. You know, like Lebanon is like covered in forests. Iran, mountains, forests, crystal waters, streams, and not like little tiny reserves. I'm not talking about oases. It's like half the whole damn country. So there's lots of images in our mind about topography and people and attitudes. And all of these are what Edward Said calls Orientalism. It's like these toxic Western constructs about what the rest of the world looks like. So it makes you be like, that's not a place I'd want to visit. The people there must be messed up. It's probably the weather. So yeah, the world is a beautiful place. So let's see. Yeah, people asking about recordings. Persistent Tiger, and just you have to check and make sure she's not a bot, because pretty soon the bots are going to start, you know, cloning her too. But Persistent Tiger or Gaia Victory are my admins that help for people that want to know how to save these and help my project go. It's actually like you'll get perks, but you're doing it because I'm running this whole channel. Like no one pays me to like run the whole channel, do the news and the analysis and cultural critiques along the way. I'm doing that for the public and people who really believe what I'm doing is good and they want to save this stuff. There's a method for that. So that's who will message you, Persistent Tiger or Gaia Victory. Yeah, so I'm looking at questions. Well, I'm glad you guys are having a healthy conversation. I don't want to ever stop that. It's, like I said, it's my fault for not saying where the questions would be. That's what I should have done. Anaretta asks, what's Macron's role in this conflict? Thank you, Anaretta. Hope you're still listening. Macron is just a representative of several forces in France. He represents French power structure and transatlantic power structure. He represents bankers, but he represents both the kind of large privileged bank owners that are behind central banks in many ways or benefit from central banks, government banks that have exclusive non-competitive deals with the largest private banks. So, but he's not at all on the side of the middle class or the working class. But that conflict with, there's a conflict between the elites in France that support him. So he actually has or had in the Libyan conflict, a tacit alliance with Russia against Turkey. And I haven't kept up with the status of that conflict in a while because I thought that the things happening in my own country, the U.S., were more important. And I can't focus on everything happening at once without only having a superficial understanding of those things. I like to hyper-focus and hyper-specialize in a moment on the things that are really changing the world. And I didn't see the conflict in Libya as being a big determining factor on the outcome of world events that much. But you can see kind of the alliances that formed up there. And Macron was there for that. So I think the people that control him can be reasoned with. And I see a lot of emergent reasonableness among European leadership, but I think that they are under tremendous pressure, and there's tremendous sellouts and tremendous idiots that exist for careerism. And Europe is different from the United States because the feudal nobility never went away. And they just, I mean, there's been, like in France, there's been different, before the later iterations of later republics, like you had this back and forth between the Bonaparte and Bourbon dynasties going back and forth ever since the end of the French Revolution. But the moneyed families more or less kept their money. And then after the feudal titular system officially ended, like they still have their money, and they kind of just went into investments and portfolios and real estate and industry, and their kids get all the privileged jobs. Like they go to the schools, they just, the letters from the, you know, parliamentarians and the generals, and that's, you know, the clergy. France is a very feudal aristocratic country in terms of its inherited power structure, which means that a lot of the people are used to having what are called sinecure positions. Sinecure, S-I-N-E-C-U-R-E. It means it's like on paper, it's a job and you get a guaranteed salary, but there's nothing that you do. It's a title. You have like a desk or something somewhere that you never have to touch. Maybe three times a week for an hour just to have an excuse to buy suits and get chauffeured somewhere and take selfies for your mom to show her friends that you do something. That's like the French power structure. I know that's weird, but that's France. Imagine a whole country functioning like that. Well, they lost their empire, didn't they? Trying to function like that. But Macron's position in this conflict, he's not a, you know, he doesn't make decisions. He comes from that, by the way, what we just described. And, but I think that they're basically, what applies to France applies to all of Western Europe. And it really, the question was asked before, like, why is Europe trying to commit suicide? And it's like, no, this is like a threat. This is trying to act crazy. This is like, and Russia's kind of calling a bluff. Like, oh, you really want to go to the Dark Ages? You really are going to shut off your power and have 4,000% inflation overnight? You're really going to be like Weimar Germany and people are going to have wheelbarrows of money to buy loaves of bread and shit like that? Like, is that really what you're going to do in a country with, in a continent with tens of millions of unassimilated migrants, radical clerics holding daily prayer that operated as part of a global intelligence network to fuel European jihadis into the Libyan and Syrian wars. And then when those wars ended, they didn't stay there. They went back to France, Germany. That's what the refugee crisis was in 2015. It was like, let's get our guys out. Their families were in Turkey and in Lebanon. Now you hear 200,000, we're going to evacuate 200,000 Ukrainians to the U.S. Really? And is that 200,000 chosen at random, or are there particular belief systems and connections and characteristics of those 200,000 Ukrainians? might they be the more Nazi Ukrainians? And that was the next question someone asked. Is this Nazi phenomenon in Ukraine a threat to Europe? It's a threat to the U.S., it's a threat to Europe, because the death squads are going to be operationalized as going to be larger kill teams, larger terrorist networks that can do crazy things. It's just Operation Gladio. You had Operation Gladio and you had Gladio B, and Azov and Adar and the Right Sector are all products of Gladio B. Basically, Operation Gladio was the CIA kept transformed groups of people. Okay, so you had Hitler, like regular army, and then you had the SS, and then you had people from within the SS that were like particular psychopaths that would do the torturing and, okay, line up all the kids on the wall and shoot them. Because the truth is that regular army people, even though they might have enough morale to like go, you know, invade Russia and fight a war, I think only 10 or 20% of the whole population of Germany were actually Nazi Party members, even at the height of Hitler's power. And, you know, I'm not trying to lessen or dampen, you know, what went down. I'm actually trying to explain the kill teams and the death squads are a minority. You know, I'm not saying that was the war crimes were confined to that minority. I'm saying like the, where you actually like execute people, like totally innocent civilians and stuff, is a minority relative to the army. Okay. And those people were kept out of prison who survived, who were not killed by the Red Army, were kept out of prison, and they were trained by when the CIA formed and integrated higher Nazi command to form the CIA. That's where like the Bush dynasty and all this stuff is, like the marriage of the Nazis with the American intelligence system. And they created this Operation Gladio to do terrorist attacks, like bombings and stuff inside of Europe, to change the culture and to create an atmosphere of fear that was superimposed onto the atmosphere of rebuilding. And so you can see those two themes reemerge again. If they can pull off the destruction of Europe or the United States, if that's what they want, if that's what they really want to do, and not just pretending that they meant to do that all along, and you know, there's so many layers there, but if that's one way that things go, then they're going to have these kind of kill teams and stuff from Ukraine. And it doesn't have to be, 10%. Or 1% of Ukrainian refugees, who I'm sure 90% of them are just normal people that don't want to live in a country that's at war, that's being invaded, let's say. Why not, right? Call it what it is. So, yeah, of course it's going to be those kill teams and stuff. When they send helicopters in to extract, you know, Azov commanders and stuff, like, who do you think was training them? You had like British death squad commanders. These people are insane. There's footage of these guys, special forces, SAS, Australians, British, Americans in Afghanistan. There's like real footage on what, like those websites that show like the little tiny clips. And they're like machine gunning kids and stuff. They just love to kill. It's a mental, it's like there's people you can go to prison, you know what I mean? Such as you can go to prison, you can go to the army, right? So it's like, it's crazy. I hope that explains. Yeah, they definitely will operationalize all these people. Ray is asking, this will be my last question. Australia, UK, and USA. New military bloc, AUKUS, will it replace current NATO bloc as such, therefore separate EU military alliance? Yes. That's what I've written about. I actually wrote about this. that the rise of AUKUS is the end of NATO. And AUKUS is the Australia, UK, and US. That is a Trump era development that the Biden administration was forced to do for reasons that people who understand my thinking will understand and appreciate as further evidence. And indeed, Brexit was part of that plan. The difficulty with AUKUS is logistical supply line type stuff. Because Australia, New Zealand are, you know, now New Zealand and Canada are not included in this. New Zealand and Canada are not included in this, and you can see exactly why. Because look particularly at Ardern and Trudeau. They have been the most pro-globalist. And AUKUS is a different vision. I'm not saying that it's noble, righteous, or any of these things. I'm not saying they won't use some of the same assets or, you know, train killers or anything like that. I'm just saying what it represents objectively is the decline of transatlanticism and a realization, diverting of resources and thoughts into at least basically the Commonwealth, the UK Commonwealth, and US is the ultimate idea of that. Now that will be hard for Australia and New Zealand economically, if you know, on that in terms of the physical economy. If China controls the waterways, China could annihilate Australia within 6 months if there was a conflict. So, but economically, all of these things, AUKUS as a military bloc, if it's going in the direction of an economic bloc, it would have to be based upon a currency that was backed by raw materials, food, precious metals, like physical things. And then, of course, you could use digital balance keeping. I mean, you could go back to, you know, promissory notes from 1,000 years ago, rather than carrying money across, you know, the deserts or the oceans, right? I mean, you can carry pieces of paper. You can, you know, there's ways for Australia to be economically involved with the other Australia, New Zealand to be involved with the rest of the Anglophone world. Absolutely. But not based on the way that economics has been conceived since for some time. At least, well, in practical terms, since the, you know, Bretton Woods system. Yes. And ABC is asking, this is a follow-up, then, if AUKUS is going to replace NATO, then that means the EU has failed as a project then? Because EU is a very long project, pretty much financed by Soros. No. The EU hasn't failed. It's failed as a vector of transatlanticism, but the EU project is actually different from NATO. And in many ways, transatlanticism has frustrated the development of a rational type of union of European nations, if that makes sense. The plans always work through each other's plans. Okay, the differing vision always works through the just think about Europe the day after, you know, VE Day. Where do you start with? The Marshall Plan, rebuilding. Europe's in ruins. So transatlanticism was a fact. It wasn't a theory, an ideal, or a goal. It was a fact. Now, there are European power elites that are ideologically and financially connected overtly to transatlanticism. And then there are European power elites that see the limitations of the way that what that relationship costs versus its benefit. And when they do a cost-benefit analysis, they see that a sovereign European Union is better. And that allows them to make deals with Russia on energy and technological cooperation and many other things, scientific, much easier and much more cost effective and or more beneficial. Same thing. So yes, that's the way that Joaquin's mind, in whatever capacity it functions still, understands the world. Absolutely. So you can see, anyway, to conclude, that the conflict in Ukraine is a game changer. It's going to happen. The changes are happening very quickly now. Many of the things that we've been waiting to be exposed in the public for 2, 3, 4, 5 years are coming out. This is changing a lot. This is changing a lot more in Europe. I want to explain one last thing that will make sense to people. Europe, the audience of RT in Europe, still many people on the center left and the social democratic left, the liberal and social democratic left in Europe. And they don't have to see Russia as like the light of the world in some like Edgar Casey sense or have religious views or anything. A lot of people are atheists or they're agnostic. But the things that were only considered conspiracy theories in the US and on the fringe of the post-politics, post-left, right-adjacent politics of Europe and the US, more in the US as like the populist right, whatever that means, is in Europe for Russia to be coming out with the stuff about the chemtrails, with the, you know, pathogens and the maybe coronavirus was made in a bio lab and Hunter Biden and Joe Biden and all of these things and more coming out in big audiences in Europe is now going to get people who are Greens, social democrats, center left liberals in the European sense, awakened. This awakening keeps happening and happening. And I know people are impatient about it, but let me just conclude with one positive note. As I always say, awakening only happens in one direction. You can never unsee the things that you've seen. Once you're awake, going back to sleep is a bizarre decision where you're trying to delude yourself and stick your head in the sand and you know it isn't true and you're really more just demoralized. But then when you see signs of life, you're like, yeah, that's what's going on. Once you're awake, that's it. Once your eyes are open, they're open. Once you've seen those things, you never unsee them. And that's how these shifts in consciousness operate. So these revelations from the MOD and through being, you know, revealed through peer-to-peer social media, through activists and free thinkers and bloggers and Russian media and, you know, if Telesur starts reporting on this stuff the way Russia has, it's going to have a big influence even on the kind of Latin American fetishist wing of the American left. It's going to split wide open, those Trotskyites. It's going to split them right open. People are going to wake up on the left from this Russia stuff a lot, is my point. So everything looks okay when you know, from the view from 30,000 feet, looking at the battle map of the Great Awakening, I see the Great Awakening defeating the Great Reset. Thank you very much. Have a great rest of the day.